Before we get started with today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight, we want to let you know that we have exclusive bonus content on Patreon at patreon.com/ampedup. You can find the video versions of all our interviews, as well as bonus content with me, Ryan's producer, Rob Bermudez. So make sure you check out our bonus content today at patreon.com/ampedup. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Lee Carter. Lee represents the 50th District in the Virginia House of Delegates, and he is running to be the next governor of Virginia. Lee, welcome to Amped Up.
Thank you so much for having me, Ryan.
Yeah, since this is your first time on the program, can you just share a little bit about your backstory and why you were running to be the next governor of Virginia?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't come from a normal background for a politician. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not wealthy. I'm a Marine Corps veteran and an electronics repairman. And I got involved in politics because I got hurt at work in the summer of 2015. And I had to deal with the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission. And that experience of dealing with them was just so abysmal that I started going around to people that worked in and around Virginia politics and asking them what they were going to do about workers' comp. Nobody had an answer. And so it was this very Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of thing where I was like, all right, well, you know, if nobody's going to fix this, I guess I'm going to go ahead and, you know, put my name out there and try. And I took on a fight that everyone said was impossible. I took out a member of Republican Party leadership in a district that was gerrymandered specifically for him. And I was able to turn, you know, what was a solidly conservative district into now a bastion of progressive politics. And the way I was able to do that was by building a multiracial working class coalition of people who had never voted in a general assembly election before and getting them out to the polls by, you know, having a message that you have an opportunity to vote for something truly different. And you know that I'm different from the rest of the political class because I'm not taking any of the money that they do. Right. I've never taken a single dime from for-profit corporations or industry interest groups. I never have and I never will. And I'm bringing that same exact fight to the race for governor. I'm the only candidate in this five-way Democratic primary who's never taken a dime from fossil fuel corporations. I'm the only candidate in this Democratic primary who's never taken a dime from big banks or from organized police. And that's because from day one, I've said no to every contribution from for-profit corporations and industry interest groups. And that's what it takes to break past people's cynicism, right? You know, these people by the millions who are out there that are not voting, it's not because they don't care. It's because you can say whatever you want to them and they don't believe you. And you've got to walk the walk to have them believe you and actually show up on election day.
Well, that's right. And also, I mean, the 100 million Americans who don't vote every general election, I find it funny when you know, certain Democrats, more establishment Democrats, will try to shame them when it's like their bank accounts aren't lying to them. Their bank accounts stay the same, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. And what I like about your backstory is that you got involved in politics because you saw firsthand that the system is rigged and it's rigged against poor and working class people like yourself. So as a working class person, you wanted to get off the sidelines and get involved to make it work for people like you. And I think that is it's just a very authentic and real message when you have a political system that has completely been corrupted by money, you know, by big money, by corporate money, and continues to serve the ruling class, despite the fact that we live in a moment in history where the economic inequality is higher than it has ever been in history. And so people are fed up. They're tired of it, and rightfully so. In your new campaign ad, you say, and I quote, "It's no secret that Virginia is divided, but it's not divided between red and blue. It's not divided between big cities and small towns. It's divided between the haves and the have-nots." This is really the great truth about American politics. The real divide is not Democrat versus Republican. It's the people versus the corporate oligarchy. They pit the people against each other because so long as the people are busy, you know, fighting each other, they won't notice that both corporate parties are busy rigging the system against us and for their corporate donors. Can you expand, Lee, on how both parties have been so effective at dividing us? And then how are you and your campaign, how are you working to build solidarity across the working class?
well, you know, it's obvious that the Republican Party is just outright hostile to working people, right? It is just outward, blatantly, you know, if you're poor, screw you. That's their message. The Democratic Party, you know, at least since the last of the New Dealers were purged, has been this sort of compromise party, right? Where it tries to say, you know, we stand for working people, and also we don't want to alienate big business. And unfortunately, those two things are just not compatible. You know, the party tries to walk that tightrope over and over and over again, and it keeps on failing.
Right.
And this is something that, you know, it's not a new phenomenon. This goes back, you know, even before World War II, right? You know, FDR, when he was running for re-election in 1940, they were trying to replace his vice presidential pick with someone who was more corporate friendly. And he wrote a letter to the DNC and said, the Democratic Party has to pick a side. It's only ever been successful when it has unequivocally been for working people with no regard to the interests of big business. And if the party continues to try to straddle the fence, I'm not going to be its nominee because I'm not going to lose for you. And that's, you know, that was one of the few moments in history where the Democratic Party actually fought back against corporate interests. Of course, you know, there are critiques to be had of the New Deal era, right, where, you know, it in certain ways didn't go far enough. And, you know, it didn't, the New Dealers didn't do the work of, you know, purging their internal biases and you know, racist biases in particular from their political programs and making sure that it actually served everybody.
Right.
But they were fighting against corporate interest unabashedly. And for that, they were overwhelmingly rewarded, right? FDR is the only president in U.S. history to be elected four times because he told the big corporate interest to go pound sand.
Right.
That's what people want. That's what they've always wanted. That's what they're going to continue to want until they get it.
Yeah, well, and I like that you point out the contradiction that you cannot be for big business and for the working class. You really do have to pick a side. You know, they are opposing interests. When you have big businesses like Amazon right now that are fighting against workers who are trying to unionize, you know, when you have big businesses that don't even, that are making record profits and don't even want to pay for all their employees' healthcare and are not paying their workers a living wage. There are millions of people who got up in America today and drove to work 8-9 hours to not make a living wage. Right. If the living wage should be $24 an hour, if it rose with inflation and also with the rise in workers' productivity, but mm-hmm. it's $7.25 an hour. And I think we just saw in this latest fight, with the American Rescue Plan, that definitely doesn't go far enough. But we saw that the Democrats, like, you know, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, went to the mat for the class they represent, which is big business, and the progressive politicians and definitely Joe Biden, they didn't go to the mat to fight to make sure the $15 minimum wage was included in the package. And so my question for you is, you know, establishment politicians in both parties are unapologetic in how they fight to preserve the status quo and protect the interests of the ruling class. Is it time for all progressive and socialist politicians to be as unapologetic in their fight against the failed status quo and for the interests of the working class?
I think so. And, you know, we have heard in the last few days some rumblings from congressional Democrats that they're going to have the minimum wage fight again here soon. And hopefully we get a different outcome. But, you know, just the fundamental contradiction when you know, the thing that makes you have to pick a side is how the workplace operates. It's how decisions are made in the workplace, where power resides in the workplace, and how the money is distributed, right? If you make $20 an hour at a for-profit business, it's because the work that you're doing is worth at least 21, period.
Right.
End of story, right? If the work that you're doing is worth $20 an hour and you're getting $20 an hour, there's $0 in it for the company. They are never gonna hire you for that. You are never, ever, ever going to get paid what you're actually worth at a for-profit business, because the difference between what you're worth and what you're paid is the profit, period.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole business model of capitalism. I mean, it is a system of exploitation. It is a system that exploits the labor of the poor and the working class to enrich the ruling class. So fundamentally, when you start, when you understand capitalism, when you study Marx, you realize, you know, what you're talking about is that surplus value, that that you cannot have dignity and justice for all people under a decrepit capitalist system. You know, but here we are living in this decrepit capitalist system. And for the time being, you know, even as a, you know, I consider myself a revolutionary socialist, but I still, you know, I will support politicians like yourself who will fight for strong social reforms because I understand that overthrowing capitalism and developing a true kind of socialist economy, that is a big fight. And so in the meantime, if we can get some immediate relief to people, which would be strong social reforms like a living wage, like Medicare for all, you know, like UBI, like reparations, that's going to, that's a big deal. And so I'm never going to be against that. But the problem I think we have is that the politicians who call themselves progressive or even democratic socialists, they aren't going to the mat and fighting for strong social reforms. They're capitulating and apologizing and defending the corrupt democratic establishment, which is fighting against all these strong social reforms.
Well, and, you know, it is kind of hard from my perspective to blame folks for that, because I've seen how the Democratic Party operates when someone from the left gets into power. Right. And that, you know, the leadership tries to take you under their wing and tries to say, you know, all those things you said on the campaign trail, they're great, but this is how we do things here. Mm. Right. And I'm going to teach you how to be effective here so that you can actually deliver on the things that you promised. And you need to not make waves. You need to build relationships with people that are far more conservative than you, and so on and so forth. And that's something that I've never really done. You know, my biggest legislative accomplishments actually were bipartisan, but not because I'm friendly with the Republicans. It's because I pick these things to fight for that are, you know, that are unambiguously popular, right, across the political spectrum. And that are such, you know, undeniably good ideas that even folks on the other side of the aisle look at it and go, yeah, I really don't want to vote no on that. Hmm. Right. So, you know, one of the biggest ones was a cap on insulin copays. I put in a bill to cap insulin copays at $30 for a 1 month supply. The Senate changed it to 50. You know, we were able to get that passed. And my chief co-patron on that was the Republican whip. Hmm. Right. And the reason for that was because he had a personal family connection with folks that are insulin dependent. And so he saw firsthand the cost of insulin. And, you know, there are shortcomings to that. I really push up against the limit of what I can do with state law, because a lot of insurance plans are federally regulated. And I literally just don't have any authority to fix those. But for the people that I could help, you know, those folks are not going to be paying $1,000 for 6 months of insulin anymore. Right.
So that's huge. No, that is huge. I mean, that's the kind of policy we need nationwide. But you were able to do that on a state level because, and what I think is so fascinating about the story, and I'm so glad you shared it, because you didn't get this accomplished by compromising your values. It was actually the exact opposite. You got it accomplished by fighting for your values and fighting for what you believed in and not backing down and not doing this kind of, you know, insider, you know, like you were sharing before that, where the Democrats say, well, okay, that's great what you campaigned big and bold, but now we got to temper that and we got to moderate it. You actually stood up, you stood strong. And because of that, people who could die because they can't afford insulin are now going to get their insulin at a reasonable price. And that's the kind of courage and the kind of bold fight that we need to see, I think, everywhere in this country right now.
Yeah. And it's important to, you know, fight for things that help in the here and now.
Right.
But also to keep an eye on the end goal.
Right.
And my end goal for healthcare is a universal healthcare system that guarantees everyone can see a doctor, period. Right. Not access, not affordability, none of these weasel words.
Right.
Just straight up. You need to see a doctor when you need to see a doctor. And the only thing that the patient should ever have to worry about is getting better. Not a bill, not whether or not it's in network, not whether or not they're going to go bankrupt, nothing. Just getting better. Mm. And, you know, Virginia is primed and ready, more so, I think, than any other state for that kind of a system, because we have such a high population of military and veterans. Mm. Per capita, we have the most of any state in the union. And so we've got these you know, literally millions of people who live in Virginia that have been on a government-run healthcare program. And they've seen, you know, firsthand that it is better than private insurance.
Right.
Right. When I was in the military, when I got hurt, when I got sick, I went to medical and they fixed me. And that was it.
Right.
And that's how it ought to be. You know, all the logistics, all the billing, all the paid fors, all that should be handled on the back end by you know, bureaucrats that are experts at dealing with that. It should never be your responsibility to say, oh, you know, can I afford this specialist to treat my heart problem? Am I going to get a surprise bill? Is it going to drive me into bed? No, none of that. Just go see the doctor you need to see.
Yeah.
That's the kind of system that we need. And while I'm fighting for that, I'm also going to, you know, put in place these policies that make things better while we're having the bigger fight.
Absolutely. One thing that I thought was so interesting last year was when Donald Trump, you know, President Trump, he rails against socialized medicine and you know, which affects many of his supporters. Well, then he gets the coronavirus and it's none other than socialized medicine, which really helped him, saved his life and got him better. And so it's so interesting how it's like that, just the propaganda campaign that both, you know, Republicans and corporate Democrats use to fight against socialized medicine, because they're beholden to the giant insurance companies. I mean, that is the only reason that establishment Democrats and Republicans don't fight for Medicare for All, because they are beholden to big pharma and these giant insurance companies. So once again, as we started the show off, it's the money, it's the big money that is stopping the change that we need in this country to heal the people. I want to ask you about one of your policies that you're running on and for governor, because it really caught my attention. It is a cannabis tax to fund reparations. Yeah. I strongly support reparations, and I feel like it is the one issue on the left that is not talked about enough. Can you talk about your policy and why reparations are so important?
Yeah, so the law that perpetuates the injustices of the past and keeps them going in the present and into the future is the law of compounding interest, right? We have an economic system where it takes money to make money. And for hundreds of years, we systematically stole from Black and Indigenous Americans to enrich the government and to enrich a small handful of wealthy landowners and business owners. And so, you know, when the government stopped actively pursuing these policies, it didn't actually fix the effect of them, right? Because, you know, after the Civil War, when we abolished chattel slavery, we never made up for the labor that was stolen from those who were enslaved, right? We never gave them the means to produce things for themselves, right? So the folks who were emancipated went from being enslaved free labor to being cheap market labor for the same exact people, doing, in a lot of cases, the same exact tasks, and perpetuating the same exact inequality, and we never fixed it. So, you know, if we're going to have justice and equity in this country, we have to make up for the injustices of the past, and we've never done that, right? Yep. And every level of government has something that it needs to atone for.
That's right.
We saw, you know, the city of Evanston, Illinois was actually the first government in America to actually proactively pass any form of reparations, right? We can talk about whether or not it's sufficient, but they are the first government at any level to pass any form of reparations. I want Virginia to be the first state to do the same, because Virginia was directly complicit in a lot of those crimes. The genocide of Native Americans, the Virginia government was complicit in that. Chattel slavery, Virginia's government was complicit in that more so than most. Redlining, Jim Crow, the war on drugs that's still going on today, Virginia's government has been complicit in those. And so we have a lot to atone for. A cannabis tax revenue is not going to make up for all that we have done, but it can be a start. And it can also, you know, provide that political momentum for people to shame the federal government into doing the same for its part in those crimes, where, you know, just like I'm pointing to Evanston, Illinois and saying this little city is doing it, our state needs to do it. People all across the country will be able to go to the federal government and say, Virginia's doing it. Why aren't you? Right. And that's the way that we are going to make up for that and get everybody onto equal footing. And then ultimately, what we need to do is break free from the economic system that, you know, is very much a continuation of what we, you know, what we founded this country on. Right. Right. The system of stolen labor. Right. So the way that we're going to do that is by taking on Wall Street and saying, we're not going to give you subsidies anymore. We're not going to look at you as magical job creators anymore and beg and plead you to come take care of us. We are going to take that money that we were putting into the hands of big business, and we're going to put it directly into the hands of working Virginians all across this Commonwealth. And we're going to say, this is the money that you need to start up your own employee-owned enterprise, right? This is quite literally, if you want to use Marx's terminology, we're talking about the means of production here.
Yep.
Right? So you can create your own employee-owned enterprise to serve the needs of your community, that keeps ownership in your community, that keeps the money in your community, and that you have control over, right? Not Jeff Bezos, not Elon Musk. They're not going to be making decisions about your economic destiny anymore. You are, right? Because you are the one who owns your workplace. And on the small scale, there are examples of this in Virginia already. On the small scale, it can look like a diner where every couple of weeks, they clear off the tables after they close the doors and they bring out the balance sheet and the schedule and they figure out who's going to work what shifts and, how much money is going to go to compensation, how much is going to be reinvested into the business, blah, 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 blah. But it's the employees that are making those decisions because they are the ones who own the business. Mm-hmm. On the large scale, it can look like the Mondragon Cooperative, which is the world's largest worker-owned business. It started in a church basement in Spain in the 1950s. Now it has 87,000 employee owners, and it operates in 90-some-odd different countries.
Wow.
And it's never had a layoff. Never had a layoff. Because the CEO has to run for re-election among the worker owners. Right? That's the way that we're going to break this cycle of perpetuating injustices through the economy, is by putting people in charge of the economy. And we've got to start that by putting the folks that we have intentionally disadvantaged for 400 years in the driver's seat of their own economic destinies.
Absolutely. Well, you just look at the data. I mean, the biggest problem in America is economic inequality, but that disproportionately impacts Black and brown people. And all you have to do is look at the data. The Black-white wealth gap in America is as wide today as it was back in 1968 during the civil rights movement. That's over a half century. We have not improved the Black-white wealth gap. And so when you read what you absolutely just said, it's systemic. It's based on atrocities that were committed against Black people in this country. And one thing that just kind of drives me crazy is how people look at something like reparations as it being, I don't know how they can, but as negative. You know, making amends is not negative. It's positive. It's what you have to do to move forward as a country and as a nation. You can't just gloss over and pretend like everything's okay. You know, I think, unfortunately, the dominant people in society write the history books. And we definitely know that white supremacist capitalists have written our history books because everything they write about America is totally glossed over, from slavery to even the civil rights movement, how they don't even want to acknowledge that MLK was a democratic socialist or acknowledge that Malcolm X was an anti-capitalist or acknowledge that, Fred Hampton was a Marxist. You know, it's all the capitalists, they whitewash the history. And so the problem is we've never atoned for these sins. We've never done anything about it. And so the inequality just compounds itself. And I think it's also important to state that it doesn't mean just because we fight for reparations, it doesn't mean that we're not also fighting for economic policies that also lift up white Americans who are also struggling. You know, there's no competition. You know, and why would we ever pick between racial justice and economic justice? Because we need both. We have to understand that they're interwoven to them.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of politicians, unfortunately, though, in the establishment who kind of weaponize identity politics and kind of say, well, yeah, we care about Black and brown people and pander for their votes. But then they get into office and they don't do a damn thing to improve the lives of black and brown people. I mean, Joe Biden is calling for more police funding. You know, Joe Biden doesn't support reparations. You know, Joe Biden isn't really fighting for any kind of, any policies that would improve the material conditions of black and brown people. But they do a lot of pandering and they use a lot of platitudes. And so it kind of creates this division the neoliberals do, where they kind of try to say that they represent marginalized communities, but their policies actually represent Wall Street and they kind of exploit marginalized communities. And so it actually, it takes us further away from the justice that we all, that the people deserve and that we need in this country.
Well, you know, you mentioned police funding there, and Virginia is a kind of a prime example of that. You know, we saw with the racial justice protests over the last summer, right, there was this massive demand for structural change,
yep,
within our police system and our incarceration system. And, you know, that call was strong enough that Virginia's leadership felt compelled to call a special session. Right. So we called the General Assembly to special session specifically to deal with police violence. And at the end of that, the state police budget went up and we gave a bonus to the state police.
It's unbelievable.
Two of our competitors in this primary voted for that bonus to the state police.
Unbelievable.
Right.
Doing the exact opposite of what the actual activists on the ground are calling for.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know,
any activist, Black Lives Matter activists.
And I'm usually loath to name names on this, but specifically, you know, I was not running for governor at this point. But this was one of the moments that made me decide to was, you know, on May 30th, at the very start of that wave of protests, I started getting messages from my constituents, and my friends saying, you know, come out here on the other side of town at the corner of Sudley Road and Sudley Manor. The Prince William County Police and the state police are firing tear gas. They're shooting people with rubber bullets. Mm. They're really brutalizing people. You got to come out here and do something. And so, you know, I called ahead to folks on the county government, let them know that I was coming. They should, you know, inform the police. I get down there. There's a police officer a couple blocks away that's blocking traffic. I let him know who I am, why I'm there, and that I'm going to be going down so that they know to expect me. And then I'm going to be asking questions. So he radios ahead. They know I'm coming. You know, walking between his position and where it was actually going on, I'm talking to the folks at the Prince William County Police headquarters, and they're telling me, we don't even have tear gas. We don't even have rubber bullets. None of these things are true. I get down there. The first thing I notice is the smell of tear gas, right? Which they told me that they didn't even have. So right off the bat, I know they're lying to me. And let me tell you, you know, George Bush's tear gas and Ralph Northam's tear gas feel exactly the same. First-hand experience on that one.
Right.
But I get down there and they knew I was coming. I held up my ID. I said, I'm a member of the General Assembly. It was radioed ahead that I was coming. I want to talk to who's in charge. And they just stared at me silently with rifles pointed at my chest. I went back and watched the video. It was 92 seconds before I got an answer. And that answer was a flashbang grenade. Hmm. And so, you know, I realized right then that the police are just out of control.
Right.
And, you know, they were intent on brutalizing my constituents. And I could hear the chatter on their radio. They were preparing to charge the crowd and make mass arrests. And so I put my body in between the police and my constituents and turned it into an hour and a half long standoff where they threw two flashbang grenades at me. They launched a third one out of a grenade launcher at me. They hit me with shields twice and they pepper sprayed me. But at the end of the day, they did not make those mass arrests. Mm. Right. And one of the major deciding moments in me running for governor was seeing the response to that from the rest of the Democratic Party of Virginia. And like I said, I'm usually loath to name names, but one of my competitors, former delegate Carol Foy, her response to it was to say, my protest is passing legislation. Those were her words. And then we went into that special session and she voted to raise their budget. That was one of the major deciding moments in you know, me getting into this gubernatorial race, because I realized that, you know, when it came to actually standing up to the power of organized police, nobody who was running for governor was going to do it.
How did the people respond when someone like you, who is an assembly member, that you were willing to put your body on the line, that you were willing to actually go out? Because we don't see that enough. I mean, these politicians, especially in Washington, but even on the state level, I mean, I don't see my politicians here in California going out there and putting their bodies on the line to defend their constituents. You know, how did the people react that you were willing to do that? And then how did that make you feel that, like, you were willing to go there and not just talk the talk, but actually walk the walk and actually fight right alongside the people in your district to actually protect them? Because I think that's really missing in public leadership. You know, I don't see many leaders out there. I don't see many people who like you, Lee, who have the courage of their convictions to actually go to go and actually stand and to do something like that.
The reaction was varied, you know, and it was largely along the lines of how people already felt about the police, right? People that recognize that the police need to change, and that they are, you know, they are a force in this country that is sort of violently resistant to any form of oversight. Those folks were very appreciative, right? You know, I got a lot of very effusive thanks from folks who have just been waiting for someone to stand up and actually do something. But then, you know, you got these back the blue, you know, MAGA type folks out there that they've made up all kinds of tall tales about me. Actually, one of the Republicans that's running for my House seat now recently told a reporter that I put a cop in the ICU, I think, which is wild. You know, I'm sort of turning into Paul Bunyan. I got a lot of actually assassination threats over the following months because of that. But ultimately, I really don't give a damn what people say about me doing what's right. I'm doing what I feel is right.
That's right.
That's it. Because I'm the type of person, I don't mind fighting and losing, right? If I fight and I lose, I sleep well at night. But if I don't fight at all and I just let injustice slide, oh, that eats me up, man. That eats me up.
That's profound. What is the point of having power if you're not going to wield that power and use it to actually fight for the people that you say you care about? You know, and I think that's really the cornerstone of the debate we see right now in the progressive movement is that, you know, there's a lot of poor and working class people who've worked really hard to get some people into Congress who said that they were going to fight for them, but then they see them kind of defending and apologizing for the very corrupt establishment that is pushing down on the people. And so, you know, we can't be afraid to fight. I think that's the whole point is you got to fight. And then if you lose, then you get back up and you fight again. Right. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's the whole point of having power, right? Well, if you're not using your power, you're wasting all that political capital. And we'd see that the establishment politicians, they know how to wield their power. they're not taking any days off. I mean, they're using their power every single day to enrich the ruling class and to maintain our decrepit capitalist system.
Yeah. And, you know, a perfect example of this is the fight to repeal right to work in Virginia. You know, you look at the field in the Democratic primary for governor. Terry McAuliffe is pro right to work, right? He said in 2013, and I quote, "Virginia is a great right to work state and we should never change that." You know, you look at Senator McClellan, who says that, you know, she supports the right to organize and collectively bargain, but she doesn't believe that people should be forced to join a union. It's that same pro right to work, you know, forced unionization talking point. And then you've got me. I've been the chief patron on the bill to repeal right to work in the Commonwealth of Virginia for the last 3 years. And this really should be a settled issue, right? The people of Virginia voted on right to work in 2016 and rejected it by an 8-point margin. And that was 5 years ago. And you know, people are much more pro-union now than they were 5 years ago.
Can you explain for people really quick who maybe don't know what right to work is?
Yeah, it's a name that sounds great.
Right. That's exactly why I want you to explain it, because this is, and this is something I talk about all the time, is you can never trust what they name the bills or what they name the laws, right? Like, let's be clear. The Affordable Care Act was called, you know, is not affordable. The Patriot Act is not patriotic. It's mass surveillance, right? Yeah. And so we have to be very careful about what they name things, because a lot of times it's propaganda used to deceive you and doing the exact opposite of what they name it.
So right-to-work laws are something that was put in place in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act, right? Taft-Hartley said federally, under federal law, unions are required to bargain on behalf of everyone in the workplace that they represent, whether or not that person contributes to the union, right? So the unions are forced to fight for benefits for people who do not contribute back. And so-called right-to-work laws are a state-level law that was authorized as part of Taft-Hartley that says not only are unions required to bargain on behalf of everybody in this workplace, but in these 27 states that have right-to-work laws, they also can't get compensation for that bargaining as part of the contract, right? Unions in 27 states are legally prohibited from having compensation for their services be a part of the contract.
Wow.
Which is unreal. And there's a blatantly racist history behind that law. The guy that came up with the idea was this Texan oil lobbyist named Vance Muse, who used racial slurs in every other sentence. So I can't even quote what the guy said about this law. But he explicitly stated that the purpose of it was to exploit racial tensions in integrated workplaces and to try to get white workers to not join integrated unions, but still get the benefit from them to bankrupt the unions, right? That was the explicit goal, but it has this really nice name.
Right. So it's blatantly anti-union, it's anti-worker and pro-corporation.
Right. But, you know, it getting rid of it should be a settled issue in Virginia in particular. Like I said, the people already voted on it in 2016. It's part of the Democratic Party's national platform. It says right in the platform document, right to work laws are wrong. The State Central Committee of DPVA unanimously passed a resolution calling for right to work to be repealed in Virginia. And let me tell you, if you put a resolution to the State Central Committee saying the sky is blue, there would be dissent because sometimes it's gray, right? Every single congressional Democrat that Virginia sends to the U.S. House is a co-sponsor on the PRO Act, which would get rid of right-to-work laws nationally. Every single one of them. I mean, even those that are on the extreme opposite end of the party from me, like Representative Spanberger, right? She is a co-sponsor of the PRO Act that would repeal right-to-work nationally. But can't even get it out of committee in the Virginia House with a Democratic majority. And so, you know, this year I put in a motion to discharge it, brought it straight to the floor. It failed 83-13. Interestingly, the chair of the committee that I was trying to discharge it from voted for the discharge motion, which I think is, you know, really, really just indicative of the fact that it is not, you know, it's not even the majority of the elected officials. It's not the majority of the majority that is holding this up. There are a small handful of holdouts that leadership doesn't want to embarrass. And I don't know who they are. We might never know who they are because they are shielding those folks from ever having to take a vote. But I strongly suspect that there are at least a handful of Democrats in the Virginia State Senate who are pro right to work and do not want to have to vote on a bill to repeal because it would put them in a tough spot. And so the House keeps falling on this grenade over and over and over again. And I keep saying, you know, why are you shielding state senators that do not give a damn about you, that do not give a damn about what's good for the people, that are fighting for this racist legacy of Jim Crow? Like, why are you jumping on a grenade for them? And there's no real answer from leadership.
But again, it kind of comes back to the debate where, in many ways, the Democratic Party, the way it presents itself and when it's campaigning, Democrats market themselves as if they're the party of the working class. Then they get power and they stab the working class in the back. And it's oftentimes where they'll use a few scapegoats, right? The Joe Manchins of the world or the Kyrsten Sinemas of the world, as we saw nationally, right, in Congress. But when it comes down to it, if Joe Biden wanted to put the $15 in the relief package, himself as well as Kamala Harris had the authority to overrule the parliamentarian. Right. So sometimes we have to stop kind of giving them the benefit of the doubt. The president of the United States and the vice president have more power than some random parliamentarian who no one had heard of until we're fighting for this $15 minimum wage. And so we have to kind of stop giving them the benefit of the doubt when time and time again, they're stiffing the working class, who they say and they campaign to. And so I think we're just in that moment where the platitudes and the lip service isn't enough anymore. People need to see material improvements in their lives. And if Democrats won't do that, then they have to get out of the way and they have to be removed from office as well.
It's the Democratic Party is not one party. It's five parties in a trench coat. and it's that way because of the way that our ballots are structured, right? The first past the post voting system forces people to hold their nose and vote for who they hate the least.
Yeah.
As opposed to actually voting for someone that they like. There's no other country on earth where Terry McAuliffe and I would be in the same party.
Right.
There's no other country on earth where Joe Manchin and I would be in the same party.
Right.
Most countries, even Joe Manchin and Terry McAuliffe would not be in the same party. Right.
Countries, like European countries, have what I would say is they still have capitalism, right, but they have a multi-party democracy. They have actual left parties. They have socialist parties. Go figure. Whereas here we have two blatantly capitalist and imperialist parties. So we don't have a social democracy. Right. We live in an oligarchy. Where both parties essentially represent the ruling class and fight against the interests of the working class.
That's right. That's one of the things that we need to change.
Yep.
But if we just change the ballot system to ranked choice or approval voting, or, you know, hell, we just completely start over with a parliamentary system where we have proportional representation. If that's all we do, then we're going to have the same problems that they have in Western Europe with those systems, right? Where, yeah, it's better than what we've got, but it's still not good enough.
Right.
Because it's still
capitalism. It's a better form of capitalism. Exactly. It's a more humane form of capitalism. But again, I think that's what for me is frustrating. When you finally kind of wake up and have that epiphany where you're like, oh, the problem is not Democrats or Republicans. The problem is our decrepit capitalist system. It's a system of exploitation. Right.
It starts in the workplace. And specifically, it starts with ownership of the workplace. Because, for 40, 50, 60 hours a week, you are spending the majority of your waking life in a place where you don't have a democracy.
Right.
Where decisions are made that impact you, that impact your community, that you don't have a say in.
Right.
And that's got to change. If you want to have a democracy, a real democracy, not just a democracy in name only, then you've got to have democracy in the workplace. You've got to have democracy in the economy. And when you do that, when you put that ownership into the hands of the people that are doing the work every day, you get a lot better outcomes.
Right.
Right.
Which is essentially socialism. I mean, we've been so indoctrinated against socialism in this country because we are such a capitalist country. It is what it is. And so, there was a story that I want to kind of bring up because it kind of speaks to what you're talking about, where there's a video game company, one of the most, profitable video game companies in the world, Activision. And they just laid off over 1,000 employees over the past year and a half. And then after they laid off those 1,000 employees, they gave their CEO a $200 million bonus. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the decisions in the workplace are not democratic and they're made by these greedy CEOs and a few executive board members, that is antithetical to democracy. And so I would argue that capitalism itself, in addition to being unsustainable, in addition to being rooted in the exploitation of the labor of the working class, it is also antithetical to democracy, that we can't actually have a democracy if we continue to just prop up and maintain this capitalist system.
Yeah. And, it's easy to attack the individual personalities at the top of the system, right? It's really easy to say that these folks are cartoonishly evil. But you know, I'm not ashamed to admit I've read Marx, right? Marx wrote about this, where they are just playing their part in what the system is making them do as well.
That's right.
Right? Like you don't get mad at a crocodile for biting your foot off. The crocodile needs to eat, right? And so the structure of the companies is the crocodile. And the structure of the companies, they're set up, they are legally required, right? The executives are legally required to do everything in their power to maximize profit for the company. Damn the consequences, right? Damn the consequences for the workers. Damn the consequences for society at large. Damn the consequences for anybody but the shareholders. They are legally required to maximize profit. And if they don't, then you know they can be ejected from the board. They can be, in some cases, jailed because they're not maximizing profits. And so if maximizing profits means that they take $1 million to buy a politician that'll give them $1 billion, they're going to do that 10 times out of 10.
Yep.
And you kind of can't get mad at them because it's what the system incentivizes them to do.
And I think that when you say consequences, I think we have to touch on that because right now in this moment in history, the consequences of this system and of maximizing shareholder wealth, what are the consequences? Well, the consequences are we're seeing historic levels of economic inequality. Yep. We are seeing historic levels of racial injustice. We are seeing climate catastrophe.
Yep.
We are seeing endless wars and economic sanctions against poor and working class people abroad. Mm-hmm. And so that is that. Those we're seeing children that are in cages. We're seeing record levels of mass incarceration. Those are all consequences of the decrepit capitalist system. And right. We're at a point where the consequences are outweighing the benefits of the system.
But those are the consequences for us.
Right.
Those are not the consequences for the people that are making the decisions.
Yeah, for the ruling class.
They don't have to live with those consequences.
Right.
The consequences that they have to live with are the consequences of not doing it.
Right.
Right? And so, I mean, there is this very real divide between the things that the world needs and the things that the people in charge need. They are two entirely different things. And the only way that we're going to fix that is by putting the people of the world in charge, right? And that starts in the workplace. It continues in our political systems. And until you fix what is at the root of the problem, you're never going to fix the problem. I think that's, you know, the biggest lesson to be learned from the New Deal. Right. The New Dealers tried to fix all the symptoms and it was great for a while for some people, but they didn't actually fix the root cause. And so the New Deal has been eroded away over decades and decades and decades because it takes energy. It takes constant effort to organize people to keep fighting for a better future for us. But money organizes itself, man.
Right.
And money has infinite patience. And if you don't change how the money works, you are never going to win.
Yep. Well, they got the money and we got the people, you know, and that is why we have to keep, you know, organizing people, building solidarity.
Right.
I want to kind of ask
you to fix how the workplace is structured.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you about, you know, there's a tendency in American politics to treat pragmatism and bipartisanship as if it's a good thing. But as we've talked about in this podcast, when both major parties are beholden to big business and the ruling class, bipartisanship usually just results in legislation that favors the rich and hurts the poor.
Yep.
As a socialist, can you talk about the pressure that you receive from both corporate parties to compromise your values and maybe share an instance where refusing to compromise your values and fighting for what you believe in has led to victories for the people in your district?
Well, I will say that over the last year or so, it seems like leadership has kind of given up on trying to pressure me. They just kind of go, oh, Carter is going to do what Carter is going to do. We're just going to plan for 51 votes without it. Right. So there is that. But you know, I think one of the biggest victories from bucking the bipartisan consensus was 2019. With what we call the tax conformity bill. And this is gonna get super wonky, right? Because I'm on the finance committee, which is the taxation committee. And so, you know, we're the kind of people that discuss tax policy at 7 a.m. on a Monday. But the Republicans had this bill that they, you know, the party in charge has to pass it every year to conform Virginia's income taxes to the changes that were made at the federal level to income taxes over the preceding year, right? It is what we call an emergency bill, which means it goes into effect immediately instead of waiting until July 1st. Because it is an emergency bill, it has a higher threshold that it needs to pass. Mm. It requires 80 votes instead of 51. And so 2019, it was the last year Republicans were in charge. They brought forward a conformity bill that actually deconformed in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that I objected to was they were trying to give a tax exemption to corporations for paying the federal GILTI tax. Now, that name alone should stand out to you, right? The feds thought that this practice was so bad that they called the tax aimed at curbing it GILTI, right? And what it was is it was a tax that corporations pay essentially when they're caught hiding profits overseas.
Ah.
Right? It's a tax that's paid on the money that's repatriated. And the feds passed this as part of Trump's tax cuts, right? It was a new tax on corporate. It was one of the very few things good that happened in tax policy under the Trump administration. And Virginia Republicans said, you know what? Any Virginia corporation that pays the GILTI tax, we're going to let them write it off of their state taxes. And oh, Jesus, you know, you can't get more blatantly morally wrong than that. So I voted no. I was the only one in the finance committee who voted no on that bill because of that exemption for the GILTI tax. That was on a Friday afternoon. And I spent that entire weekend whipping votes, trying to get 20 people to come along with me and also vote no on the floor to kill that bill. And I was successful, right? We were able to get the votes to stop it. I think they were only able to get up to like 73 or 74 votes out of the 80 that they needed on the floor. And that forced the Republicans to the negotiating table. They were the majority, but it forced them to negotiate. And because of that negotiation, you know, eventually they did get some of my allies to fold on the GILTI tax, but what they got in exchange was increased funding for K-12 schools, right? So we got increases in public education funding specifically targeted at Black and Brown communities.
Hmm.
Because there was someone who was willing to stand up and say, you know what? Both parties agree on something that's wrong here, and we're going to put the brakes on this train, and we're gonna try to do something better.
Hmm.
And so, you know, ultimately, was I able to stop the GILTI tax exemption from going into law? No, but I did get some concessions out of it.
Hmm. And I think that shows that it is as frustrating as I think it is for a lot of socialists and leftists to see just how corrupt our system is. It's a lot better, though, to have people like yourself in there and to have some allies in there that are actually going to fight for the interests of the poor and the working class and communities of color and aren't just going to give great speeches and sedate, you know, and use all these platitudes of hope and change and while they're campaigning and then just go in there and govern for Wall Street. That it is good to have allies that are working for us.
It's good to fight these fights within the system. But also remember that I can't fight the whole fight for you.
Right.
Right. You know, I'm not going to be the one that delivers socialism for everyone. Right. You've got to build it up on your own. Right. You can put people like me in positions of power to give you the tools to do it.
Right.
But ultimately, what it's going to take is people forming their own worker-owned enterprises, right? Directly breaking free from that employer-employee relationship and taking charge of their own economic destinies and building these worker-owned enterprises as pillars of their community. That's what's going to be required to get us out of the status quo. Because once you've done that, you know, once the worker-owned sector of our economy is big enough, then there's an economic pressure on politicians, even the ones that don't agree with you.
That's right.
To start working on your behalf, right? That's when it becomes self-perpetuating. That's when you have people fighting for socialism that are doing it not just as a hobby, right? Because the way it is now, even the most dedicated activists, the most dedicated activists are only fighting for socialism after they're done working for capitalists all day.
Yeah.
We've got to break out of that. We have got to make our movement self-perpetuating. There's got to be an economic base behind it. And once there is an economic base behind it, then we'll win, but not a moment before.
Do you think there's some advantages to also picking industries, say for instance, obviously the healthcare industry would be is an industry that absolutely needs to be socialized. But you know, after what we saw in Texas, where people were dying because the power companies were putting, you know, profits over people just having energy during a storm, during a winter storm. Do you think there's benefits too to, you know, fighting to socialize the energy industry? And so people see the benefits of, look, wow, you know, socialism does work. It's working here. It's working for healthcare. It's working for energy, to kind of build momentum. Or do you see the approach just needs to be, like you kind of said, you know, worker-owned enterprises, building a national, global, socialist, revolutionary kind of movement and party?
Well, I think it's important to separate, policies of government intervention from socialism, right? Those are two separate questions, right? And so there are certain sectors of the economy where it doesn't make sense to have market forces at work at all, right? Those are, I'm going to get super wonky here, but those are the sectors of the economy where either there's a natural monopoly when you're talking about things that are very infrastructure heavy, like electricity, the internet, phones, railroads, things like that. And then there's also things where demand is inelastic, where, people having more or less money in their pockets doesn't impact how much they have to spend on that. Healthcare is a perfect example of a sector with inelastic demand, because when you need to see a doctor, you need to see a doctor. You would love for that to happen when you have $2,000 in the bank rather than $2, but you don't get to pick, right? So those are the sectors of the economy where it makes sense to have more government intervention, and maybe even more government control. But the question of socialism versus capitalism is the question of who owns the rest of it, right? So under capitalism, we have a small handful of investors that own the rest of it and make decisions for the rest of us.
That's right.
Under socialism, we will own it. And you may be noticing my shirt here. This is actually a worker-owned print shop here in Virginia that is unionized through the Teamsters. It's one of the prime examples of this. But you can, in any sector of the economy, it could be a grocery store, it could be a factory, it could be, an accounting service where you help people do their taxes, whatever skills you have. If you're a plumber, if you're a delivery driver, if you're anything, if you have any professional skills, you can get together with a small handful of people that also have those same skills and create your own worker-owned enterprise where you and your coworkers are in charge of your economic destiny. That is what socialism is.
Yep.
And it's my job as a politician to give you as many tools as possible to be successful in that. But I can't make that business for you. That's your job.
What would it mean to Virginia overall to elect a socialist governor?
Well, number one, the corporate subsidies are done, right? The corporate subsidies are done overnight. Virginia spends, it varies by year, sometimes tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions. In the case of Amazon, $1.8 billion trying to bribe these corporations to come in and pretty please give us some jobs. And the problem is they're only interested in coming to a small handful of cities in Virginia, right? They want to come to Northern Virginia or Richmond or Hampton Roads, and that's it. And they don't care about the rest of the Commonwealth. But Northern Virginia, Richmond, and Hampton Roads don't have joblessness problems. So creating new jobs in those places doesn't fix the problem. Right. It just causes more people to come in and drive up housing costs, which is the actual problem.
When housing costs drive up, it displaces more poor people.
Exactly. Right. So the economic development model that we've been using makes the problem in the cities worse and ignores the problem elsewhere in the rural areas.
In the rural communities.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Where they actually do need jobs. So that's done on day one. I'm not making any more of those deals as Virginia's governor. the money that we've been spending on those deals is going to go to the people of Virginia to create their own worker-owned enterprises, right? It's going to be grants. It's going to be zero interest loans. It's going to be education on what a worker-owned enterprise is. It's going to be priority for worker-owned enterprises in state and local government contracts so that they have a built-in customer. If the Commonwealth of Virginia needs to buy 1 million pencils, we're going to buy it from a worker-owned pencil factory, right? I don't care. We're going to put money into people's hands to create their own worker-owned enterprises. That's number one. Number two, on criminal justice, right? The United States incarcerates more of its people than any other country in history. And second place isn't even close. And the overwhelming majority of those folks are locked up by state courts, not federal. So the states have all the power to stop it. Literally, all the power to stop it. And again, under a Carter administration, that's done. Virginia is done with that, right? I led the way on abolishing the death penalty. We've abolished the death penalty. I put in a bill to do it last year. It didn't get a vote. It passed this year. I've led the way on legalizing cannabis. I put that bill in for the last 2 years. It got passed under someone else's name this year. But more than that, right? We are going to look at the Portuguese model for substance abuse, which is to treat it as a medical issue, not a criminal issue.
Amen. It's
criminalized all drugs. And as a result, their opioid death rate is 10 times lower than Virginia's. Literally. I mean, ours is 30 per 100,000 people per year. Theirs is 3 or 4 per 100,000 people per year. And it's because they treat it as a medical problem. They don't try to incarcerate their way out of it.
And that also removes the stigma. I'm a recovering addict, so I appreciate that. I've been sober 10 years. And when the problem that we have in addiction is...
forward. Now my camera's out of focus.
Oh, the problem we have in this country is when you criminalize addiction, you know, addiction, it's a disease. It's a medical issue. It's not a criminal issue. But when you criminalize it, it creates a stigma, and which then creates shame, which then creates fear and hiding. And when people are hiding their addictions, that they're not able to actually ask for help. And then it creates this imbalance in society where the people who aren't addicts, you know, they look at us, they look down upon those of us who are. And it prevents those of us who need to get help from actually seeking help. So right there, just decriminalizing addiction, treating addicts as human beings who are sick and who need help, that will go so far. And we're seeing that play out right now in the Derek Chauvin trial. Mm-hmm. They're literally trying to shame him for being an addict. It's driving me nuts because in addition to, I mean, we already criminalized blackness in this country. You know, our criminal justice system is already racist. And so now they're trying, the defense of the police officer who we all saw, you know, kill George Floyd by putting a knee on his neck for over 9 minutes, they're trying to now blame opioids and blame fentanyl. Yeah. And I'm sorry, but fentanyl did not put a knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes. That was Derek Chauvin. And so we're seeing now just in this trial that it's like, in addition to, you know, I can't even imagine what it would be like for someone like George Floyd, just, you know, and me having to recover from my own drug addiction. And thankfully I was able to, but the fact that they're now stigmatizing addiction and trying to use that. And so the reason I'm bringing that up, just this morning, George Floyd's girlfriend took the stand and very forthcoming, she shared, yes, George Floyd had an opioid addiction. And so do I, and so do millions of Americans, but that's not what killed him. You know, what killed him was Derek Chauvin putting a knee on his neck. And I think that's so powerful. And I don't think she realizes how many lives she's going to save by just being honest in court and admitting that, yeah, I do have an opioid problem. George did have an opioid problem. So do millions of others. And they don't have to live in shame for it. This is a lifelong disease and we can get help and you can recover. And so I sorry to kind of go off there, but just I'm relieved to hear you say that because it's amazing how, you know, in addition to kind of criminalizing blackness, now they're trying to criminalize addiction and trying to use that to get this police officer off. It's outrageous to me. You know, what are your thoughts on that before you kind of continue?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's incredibly brave of her to take the stand and say that. You know, I haven't seen the video of her testimony myself, but I've seen some reporting on it this morning. But you know, it's beyond just that, right? You know, mass incarceration doesn't begin and end with the war on drugs, right? The war on drugs is the biggest, you know, single catalyst of it, but it's bigger than that. And so, you know, we've got to go through our criminal justice system, our criminal incarceration system, with a fine tooth comb and say, you know, what makes sense to have people with guns doing versus the things that it doesn't make sense to have people with guns doing.
Right.
Does it make sense to have a guy with a gun doing speed tickets? No, it doesn't make a damn bit of sense. Right. Does it make any sense to have a guy with a gun being the first person dealing with someone who's having a substance abuse problem?
Absolutely.
No, it doesn't. It's going to make it worse.
Right.
Does it make sense to have a guy with a gun doing welfare checks? No, it's probably going to make it worse. Right. And so we've got to take all of these tasks that don't make sense for armed men to be doing and get them off of the plate of police and into the hands of specialists that are actually trained to deal with those specific tasks.
Right.
Now, these are going to be things, you know, the Portuguese model of substance regulation, you know, defalonizing things, reducing the scope of policing. Those are all massive changes that are going to take the cooperation of the General Assembly. Right. So if the General Assembly digs their heels in under my administration, then I will take action to directly reduce Virginia's prison population. The governor of Virginia has the power of clemency. And I don't care if I have to spend a week straight doing nothing but signing clemency petitions one by one. I'm going to do it. And we're going to reduce Virginia's prison population by at least 30% in 4 years. Right. That is one of the biggest single differences between me and the rest of the field. And, you know, I'm also going to be fighting for a single payer healthcare plan. Now, I would love to have the federal government do it. It makes the most sense for the federal government to do it. They have the economy of scale. They have the currency issuing authority. You know, in tough times, they can leverage debt where Virginia can't. But that doesn't mean that Virginia can't do it. Right. Just because it's better for the federal government to do it doesn't mean that Virginia can't.
Yep.
I look at other countries for inspiration. You know, I look to Portugal for inspiration on substance regulation. I look to Austria for inspiration on healthcare. Now, Virginia has about 8.5 million people. Austria has about 8.5 million people. Their GDP is plus or minus 5% what ours is. Right. Sometimes theirs is a little higher. Sometimes ours is. Their landmass, roughly the same. Right. They have a universal healthcare system that covers everyone. We don't. Their universal healthcare system is one of the most expensive in Europe. Other European countries make fun of them for how expensive their healthcare system is. It's 30% cheaper per capita than ours. And ours doesn't even cover everybody. There's absolutely no reason why Austria, which has the same population and the same size of economy, and is also not a currency issuing authority, there's absolutely no reason why Austria can do it and we can't. The problem is not logistical. The problem is political. Yep. And if Virginia can be the first state in the nation to step up and guarantee health care for all of their citizens, then again, people in the other 49 states can use that to shame the federal government into doing it everywhere.
Absolutely. No, I had an organizer who's a part of Whole Washington on the program last month. Who is they're based in Washington and they're fighting for a single payer healthcare system in Washington, and you know they want to take the movement state by state, and they have the same approach. They still, you know, they support Medicare for all at a federal level, and would agree with you that yes, you know, we need it for everyone in this country, but because of how corrupt both corporate parties in Washington are, and because they're owned by the giant insurance companies, there's just been no courage to fight back against that in Congress and from our president. You know, Joe Biden said he'd veto Medicare for All. So these local organizers in Washington are taking power into their own hands and they're organizing. And I think that's fantastic. And they want to kind of create, you know, courage is contagious. So if they can get it in Washington, if you can get it in Virginia, we can kind of help the national fight. Yeah. It doesn't have to be an either or. We can work together. It's synergistic.
It is so wild to me that so few politicians are willing to support it because it's a 70-30 issue.
Right, right.
It's just raw numbers. It's a 70-30 issue. In poll after poll after poll, healthcare is the number one driver of changing people's minds about a politician.
Yep.
Right? It is overwhelmingly populator, overwhelmingly popular. It is a massive motivator of voter participation. There's essentially no downside except that Aetna won't like you anymore.
Right. But that's the problem. Aetna's the problem. Because right? They're filling their campaign coffers. I mean, that is unfortunately where you see the big money wins out until we get enough people power to fight right. back against it.
Right. But you know, there's absolutely no reason why the states can't do it first. And yeah.
No, I love it.
You know, even when it comes to the question of whether or not the feds should do it, I'm the only one in this Democratic primary who supports the feds implementing universal healthcare, right? It wouldn't even be committing the rest of the field to doing anything if they just said, I think it would be great for the federal government to implement Medicare for all.
Right.
Right. And they still won't go out there and go on that limb of being on the 70% side of a 70-30 issue.
It's incredible.
It's unreal.
And what else is unreal, though? It also shows that not only are the politicians and the parties they represent captured by big business, but also our media. You know, our media is big business. You know, CNN, right. and the MSNBCs of the world, you right. know, they're owned by billionaires. And so billionaire-owned media, we saw this in the primary. I mean, I watched, they would, every time Medicare for All got brought up in the Democratic primary, it was, you know, insurance industry talking points. It was so much propaganda against it. It's why they fought so hard against Bernie, even against Warren when she was supporting Medicare for All before she flip-flopped and stopped supporting it. You know, it also shows that, because in my head, it's like, well, yeah, the majority of the people want Medicare for All. So why do they keep electing politicians who don't support it? And it's because of the corporate media as well. And we saw this actually in the polling, in exit polling. There were a number of Democratic voters who actually thought that Joe Biden supported Medicare for All. And it's because, you know, he says things like, well, yeah, you know, we're the party of healthcare. And healthcare is a human right. Well, we got these corporate Democrats who say the platitude healthcare is a human right while they're actively fighting against the policy Medicare for All to make healthcare a human right. So part of it is that we just don't have good information. And that is why independent media is so important, because without it, it's just people are left getting their information from corporate media, which has a vested interest in maintaining the status quo and a vested interest in just continuing to keep the Democratic Party a corporate party and the Republican Party, you know, a corporate party.
And, you know, when the Washington Post says democracy dies in darkness, man, that's not a warning. That's an advertisement for their plan. Right. And they let these politicians get away yep. with murder yep. on issues like healthcare.
Yep.
When prominent Democrats say, you know, I have this plan that's not Medicare for All, that's going to expand access to affordable healthcare to, you know, 98.5% of Americans, the first follow-up question from a journalist should be, what number of uninsured Americans is acceptable to you?
Hmm. Yep.
And if the answer is anything other than zero, you have a problem.
Yep.
But they never ask that question.
Never.
They just say, he has a plan to expand access to affordable healthcare, right?
And not only just do we have, you know, like something like the Affordable Care Act, but a lot of people don't realize 4,000 corporate lobbyists descended on Washington to write that legislation. It is not only is it not a universal healthcare system, it is a predatory for-profit healthcare system. It left 27 million people uninsured and 92 million people underinsured.
Yep.
But again, the Democrats go on TV, Obama and Pelosi and the Hillarys of the world, and they spout these platitudes and they dress it up as if it's this good thing. And so it's the propaganda. It's the deceit. And I think that's what gets me is, you know, I was a lifelong Democrat. I was a Democrat for like 18 years before last year, where I couldn't handle the lies and the deceit anymore. It wasn't, you know, it's like they want to blame Republicans for everything while they're doing much of the same thing that Republicans are doing. And not working for their constituents. And, you know, I do appreciate what you said, that there is like five parties within the Democratic Party. But I think at some point, people have to kind of, you know, they have to be willing to put themselves out there and just say enough, you know, enough with the lies. And, you know, either you're for the people or you're for the billionaire class, you know, or you're for the oligarchy. And I think we're getting to that point in history where it's so clear, you know, whose side are you on? And what I appreciate about you and about just the ad you ran is it's very clear that you're, that, you know, you're working for the working class, that you are working for the people, that you are not going to capitulate, that you're not, you're very clear about that. And I think that is really important because I think it helps people realize what the real divide in our, in the system is, that it's not that the people aren't the problem, you know, that, that, you know, it's the politicians who divide us against each other who are the problem, that it's the decrepit system that's the problem.
It's also not a choice for me of which side I'm going to be on, right? Because I'm not a lawyer. I'm a blue collar worker, right? I'm used to quite literally fixing things with my hands. That is my professional skill from before I got involved in politics. And I know at some point my time in politics is going to be over and I'm going to go back to that, right? I don't have a partnership at a law firm waiting for me. I don't have a lobbying gig waiting for me.
Oh, you're not going to go be a corporate lobbyist like all of them do?
The only chance that I have at a better future after I leave politics is winning for the working class. That is it. That's my only shot. It's this or I'm screwed.
Right? But that's a damn good goal. And that's how it should be.
Yeah. And I went from making, you know, fairly good money fixing electronics because I had a very niche specialty. My specialty was medical devices. And so I was able to keep a roof over my family's head up until I got hurt. But, you know, I went from that where I was getting paid, you know, enough to not have to worry about the bills to now I make the, my salary as a legislator is $17,640 a year. And my rent is $2,000 a month. Do the math. It doesn't add up. Right. I've been starting my car with this and a pair of pliers for a year and a half. This ain't a choice for me. This ain't a choice for me. It's right. I'm fighting for the working class because I'm a part of it.
You're fighting for yourself.
Eugene Debs, when he was on trial, he stood up and he said, "Your Honor, I determined long ago that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I cannot be free." And, you know, that is the kind of person that I look to for inspiration. Someone who really puts it out there and fights for the working class because they recognize that fighting for the working class is fighting for themselves. And, you know, specifically this idea that an injury to one of us is an injury to all of us, right? If the government can commit an injustice against anybody and get away with it, then they can commit injustice against everybody.
That's right.
And get away with it. So we can't afford to let anybody be invisible.
Well, right? Until all of us are free, none of us are free.
Right.
It's just that simple.
And that transcends boundaries, right? It transcends, you know, it goes beyond the boundaries of my district here in Virginia. It's why I don't legislate for special interests in Manassas. It's why I legislate for the 8.5 million people that are impacted by the laws that I pass, right? It's why I have such a vested interest in things that happen in other states and in other countries, right? It's why I wasn't silent when I saw the U.S. backing a coup in Bolivia, right? It's why I wasn't silent when I saw the U.S. trying to execute a coup in Venezuela. It's because I recognize that if the U.S. can do these things to anyone, anywhere, then they can at any time do it to me here.
That's right. And we see them do it to people all the time. I mean, every day we see the war against the poor, the war against people of color, you know, the war on drugs. You know, we see every single moment. And as long as the injustice exists, you know, we have to fight against it. And we deserve, like, it's just, for me, it's so simple. Like, we deserve to live in a better world than this, all of us. Like, and we can do so much better than this. It's not like, and I think it's so simple. It's just so apparent to me. And I think, I think that for a lot of people, I think that you get used to accepting the breadcrumb so long and you just get used to, like, this is the way it is. We can't have any better. It takes people like you. It takes movements to inspire people to understand that, like, no, we do deserve better than this. And we can get better than this if we can come together and fight for something and fight for better than this. And I see that happening, you know, sometimes it can get so overwhelming, but, you know, we have to have joy in the movement. And, you know, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you today. And I kind of wanted to ask you, you recently have become a father. First, congratulations. And second, has becoming a father changed the way you approach politics? And if so, how?
Well, between my partner and I, we have a Brady Bunch, and this is number four, right? It's our first one together, but it's our fourth one total. And,
you're a busy man.
And, you know, let me tell you, when we have all four kids in the same place in a 1,200 square foot apartment in quarantine, it gets real hectic.
Right? Yeah, but, I imagine.
But, you know, look, you know, I like to give credit where it's due. You know, a very good friend of mine in the General Assembly, Delegate Kathy Tran, right? She and I disagree ideologically quite often, but we're personal friends, and I owe her a debt of gratitude for blazing a trail for new parents, right? Her 2017 campaign, when we were both running for the first time, she was out there with a newborn on her hip for the entirety of the campaign, right? When it was her turn to hold the baby, she was holding the baby. She was holding the baby behind a podium, then she was given a stump speech with a baby on her hip, right? Didn't matter. She blazed that trail and showed that a new parent, like a parent of a newborn, can go out there and be visible as a new parent and still win. And so I frankly would not have had the courage to run this campaign if not for that example. So I got to give that credit where it's due. But it's tough. You know, I'm running on caffeine more than sleep because for any of you that have kids, you know, my youngest daughter is now 28, 29 days old. Wow. And so, you know, we've reached the point where she's sleeping in 45 minute increments. And so my partner and I are taking shifts through the night, right? I stay up late. My partner wakes up early. But you know, I'm just powering through it. And sometimes I have to make campaign appearances with the baby on my shoulder, and that's fine. I can still get the message across. But I'm tired. I'm real tired, but it's worth it.
Well, Carter, I really appreciate you taking the time today. And how can my listeners, you know, get involved in your campaign? You know, I know you're just in Virginia, and you know, my listeners are spread out all over across the country. But the reason I wanted to have you on is I think you show that socialism it can work, that it can work in a state way, and it can work by having people like you in positions of power to educate. I think so much about the movement is education, is kind of empowering people, like you said on the show today, to form their own little cooperatives in their workplaces. So how can people get involved in your race, whether it be, you know, throwing in 5, 10, 20 bucks or signing up to phone bank?
So go to carterforvirginia.com. That's all spelled out, all one word, Carter, F-O-R, Virginia.com. You'll see a donate button. You'll see a volunteer button. You know, this campaign is 100% funded by people. I've never taken a single dime from for-profit corporations or industry interest groups. I never have, and I never will. I'm the only one in this Democratic primary that can say that. I don't have any six-figure donors, where all four of my competitors in this primary have cash checks for over $100,000 in a single check. Right. So we're not going to raise the most money, but we do need to raise enough to get the word out. And so I need your help on that. There's a donate button in the top right of my website. Also at the top of my website is a volunteer button. You fill that information out and we will get in touch with you with information on how to phone bank or text bank. Ideally, we're putting a lot of effort on text banking, talking to people quite literally where they can't get away from it. You know, it's the text banking is fun. It's addictive. It's literally, it's two clicks to send, the first text to somebody.
Yep.
And so you can just sit there and click, 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 click.
I've done it. It's easy.
Yeah. It's really easy. You can go through, you know, a few hundred of those initial texts in 10 minutes. And then,
and it sounds horrible, but people would much rather get a text these days than a phone call.
Yes.
And so, and it works. So let's keep doing it.
It's a conversation, you know, not everybody will respond, but when you send out enough of them, you get, you know, a couple dozen people that answer. And they're like, you know, some of them are, you know, F off communist. but most of them, most of the replies are, yeah, I'm interested. You know, tell me more about this guy that doesn't take corporate money. What does he actually fight for?
Right.
And then you get to have a conversation about policy. You get to have a conversation about, you know, what kind of a future you want to have in this Commonwealth, and how we're going to work together to build this Commonwealth as a place where wealth is common, where everyone can live and work and not have to worry about how they're going to put food on the table or make the rent, or whether or not they can see a doctor or put their kids through college, or whether they're going to be discriminated against based on who they are, who they love, or who they were born to be. That's the good stuff. And the text banking gets you to that real, real fast. So go ahead, sign up. We will get you plugged into the system, and we will get you started having those conversations with people right away.
Awesome. Lee, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight. And before we go, I want to take this moment to thank our benefactors who contribute $20 a month to the show to keep this show alive and going. So I want to thank Kenny Ballantyne, Tyler Sambucci, Nate Tecito, Lloyd Chapman, Ed Romo, John Littman, John Paul DeLuca, Susan Sarandon, DJ Comatose, Patty Cleary, and Elizabeth Kim. Thank you so much for your generous donations. And thank you, everyone, for supporting the podcast and supporting my work. I really appreciate it. Again, go to patreon.com/ampedup if you want to support the podcast as well. And for as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.